It's true. Across the globe, women aren't as prosperous as men. Gender inequality is a pressing moral issue, but we forget it has massive economic implications. If you were to put all of the women who don't have access to formal financial services in one place, they would make up the third largest country in the world. That means an entire population without bank accounts, credit cards, or other tools you and I likely benefit from daily. Prosperity for women starts with inclusive policies, products, and people around the globe, and the investment to make it happen. Welcome to the Making Finance Work for Women podcast. My name is Sonia Kelly, and I lead Women's World Banking's proprietary research division. Join me as I speak with changemakers around the globe to deconstruct the social and economic exclusion women face. We'll discover new evidence together and drive action to accelerate women's economic empowerment. Because a leg up isn't a handout, it's a global game changer. Indeed. Welcome. And thank you so much for tuning into the Making Finance Work for Women podcast, which is now streaming on YouTube, and it's also available wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Sonia Kelly. If you're listening on YouTube, you'll be able to find additional insights and resources linked in the description of the video. Before we get started on our topic this month, I'd like to give a special shout out to the sponsor of the Making Finance Work for Women podcast, Ernst & Young LLP. EY is a global leader working across assurance, consulting, law, strategy, tax, and transactions. And EY teams ask better questions to find new answers for the complex issues facing our world today. You can visit their website at ey.com to explore their latest insights and services. Now let's jump into the show. This month, it's the third Thursday, which means the podcast is being launched here in February. This month, we're talking about digital assets and specifically cryptocurrency. Now, what I've observed from my space in the industry is no longer are we talking about this as something interesting and out there. Digital assets are here to stay. The current market capitalization of cryptocurrency is estimated at $1.6 trillion US dollars. And a recent Statista survey found that nearly one in three Nigerians either owned or used a digital coin. So this isn't just the anonymous rich people in high-income economies. This is also people all over the world who are adopting this. I'd like to define our terms a little bit before I introduce our guest, because I think not everybody who's listening today knows all about this space. So first, there's cryptocurrency, and you can think of things that you've heard of like Bitcoin or Ethereum. And this is a digital asset that's not issued by any central monetary authority. It's an example of a medium of exchange, and it can be used to pay for goods and services and investing. And we can talk a little bit about the underlying technology there if we need to. There's also stablecoin, and you might think about Tether, for example, or USDC, and these are specific types of cryptocurrencies that might be pegged to an external asset, like fiat currencies such as US dollars or commodities such as gold, and they're more likely to be used as a medium of exchange because they're less volatile and might be able to be moved more easily into liquid assets. And then we also have seen emerge in the last few years central bank digital currencies, or CBDCs. And this is a digital form of a country's fiat currency. It's issued and it's regulated by a nation's central bank, and therefore it's centralized. It's a legal tender like banknotes or coins, but in digital form. And more than 80% of the world's central banks are actively engaged in CBDC activities of some sort. That's really interesting, and that's higher than you might have expected. Now, there are some principles of blockchain technology that underpin much of the digital currency space or the digital asset space. One principle is that it relies on a distributed network. Of course, this isn't true necessarily for centralized currency, but for many of them, it's a distributed network, which means transactions are broadcasted to and maintained across the network by nodes. And these nodes construct and verify record of the transactions. It's also immutable. So transactions can't be undone. It's permanent. It's unalterable. It relies on consensus. So no additional block can be added to the chain without the approval of other nodes in the network. And this is important to ensuring that every additional transaction on the blockchain is valid, or on the chain is valid, and that every node has the same version of the ledger. So there are a few ways that digital assets do this. It's also programmable or automated, which means there are a lot of kind of interesting layers that you can put on top of blockchain technology. A nice example is smart contracts, which you might have heard about, where if a particular condition is met, then the funding can be released on the blockchain. And that's the case with Ethereum, which I mentioned before. And then finally, it's permissionless, or many of these digital assets are permissionless. So for the most part, anyone with an internet connection can access blockchain solutions. This reduces the need for cumbersome documentation or onboarding. Now, let me tell you why it matters. It matters because it's growing so quickly. The global cryptocurrency market is projected to grow at an annual growth rate of 12%. To $2.8 billion by 2028. That might be trillion. I'm going to check that for you and then put it in the comments here. We also see rapid adoption. So adoption of cryptocurrency is skyrocketing. As of Q2 of 2021, global adoption had grown by 881% in terms of number of people participating. That's over the previous year, and over 2,300% since 2019. These are like enormous numbers, and they are true numbers. There's just like a huge, huge increase in rate of adoption. And emerging markets especially are poised for rapid adoption because there's a large underserved segment. There are fewer access points or penetration of traditional banking infrastructure. And according to one index that was measuring adoption that we looked at in preparation for this podcast, 19 out of the top 20 countries that were on the blockchain adoption or the digital asset adoption list, 19 out of 20 countries were in emerging markets. And the top three were Vietnam, India, and Pakistan. We've also seen central banks like formally recognize cryptocurrency. So for example, El Salvador has adopted Bitcoin as official currency alongside of the local currency. And so that's really interesting as well. So there's a lot to talk about here. Let me now introduce our guest. Our guest is Sheila Warren. Sheila is the CEO of the Crypto Council for Innovation. She was voted last year one of the most influential women in Washington, D.C. by the Washingtonian. She also founded the World Economic Forum's Blockchain and Digital Assets team, and she was a member of the executive leadership team for the Center of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. She has a really impressive resume, including briefing heads of state and heads of Fortune 500 companies and ministers and now Women's World Banking. And she's also a host of a podcast called Money Reimagined. It's a CoinDesk podcast. Welcome, Sheila. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Sonia. It's so great to be here with you.
First, before I ask you any questions, I want to ask, you listened to my intro. Are there any corrections that you want to make or clarifications? Because I'm not in this space every day like you are.
Yeah, your number was trillion, not billion. So we are hovering in 2022, which I think was the number that you cited, we were hovering around a $3 trillion market, essentially. That has come down a bit, but it goes back up here and there. So I'll just take care of that for you right off the bat.
But other than that, thank you so much.
It's great. It's a complicated space. I think you did a great job laying out some of the basics for folks.
Great. And I appreciate the correction too. That saved me a little bit of research. I always like to start by asking our guests about their origin story. Can you share a little bit more about your journey into crypto?
Absolutely. So I am a lawyer by training, as I think you mentioned, and I started off doing Wall Street mergers and acquisitions. I moved to the Silicon Valley to actually focus on philanthropy law, which is a very interesting area of law that's not really well known. I wound up building a SaaS product called NGO Source that focused on how to more efficiently identify appropriate recipients of charitable dollars, US foundation dollars primarily, to civil society organizations abroad. That was sparked by my concern around various different disaster relief efforts that tended to flow through the same organizations over and over, and really did not focus on on-the-ground organizations that also were meritorious and worthy of funding, but couldn't actually qualify under U.S. complicated tax rules. So over the course of that, I became the general counsel of a place called TechSoup, a big civic social enterprise. And that is my origin story into, that's where the origin story begins, because our CTO and I as executives became very concerned about a potential hacks on data on the database. And we were seeing an increased uptake as we added more and more activist data to our database. We were seeing more and more hacking attempts on that database. So I became interested in the blockchain primarily and originally because of data security issues, because of privacy around data issues. I was very concerned about the fact that everyone back-ended into the same server companies, et cetera. It was only later that the financial aspects of it became more prominent in my mind. And that's funny because, of course, my product that I built and launched that had its 10-year anniversary recently was focused on getting, you know, funding to organizations. So you think that would have been the first origin for me, but it actually wasn't. It was data concerns. And those, honestly, to some extent, remain active today.
Wow, that's so interesting. And you've already given us a use case, which I think is really exciting, because we really want to get into the practical uses and not just stay at kind of a high level here. And so getting us right into that conversation, I want to ask you maybe a provocative question right off the bat. I think there's a perception out there that crypto hasn't yet delivered on its financial inclusion promises. But knowing you and knowing where you started, I would guess that's not what you're seeing, because you wouldn't be doing what you're doing if that was the case. So how do you see cryptocurrency empowering women economically? And are there opportunities you see kind of going forward that motivate you, that are enhancing financial inclusion through crypto?
So yes, 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 yes. All the yeses. You know, I think that crypto, it gets a bad rap. And I think there are legitimate reasons for that. This was a provenance of criminals, you know, for some time. The good news is that those criminals have been brought to justice in multiple jurisdictions around the world. But anytime, unfortunately, you have a lot of money being made very quickly, you are not always going to attract just socially minded, let's say pro-social or altruistic individuals. You're going to attract, unfortunately, others as well. And that did happen in crypto. So that is fair. However, I do think what's missed in some of that narrative, which dominated many headlines in, you know, the end of 22 and even last year in 23, is that so much progress has been made and that we are still at the earlier days of the adoption curve of the uses of this technology. So I'll start by saying a couple of things, Sonia. I'll be a bit long-winded here, so please bear with me. One is, it's important to note that blockchain and what we call Web3 technologies, very quickly, Web2 is kind of the platform-based model many of us are familiar with. So the Facebooks and the Twitter or X's and whatnot, the idea being you go to a place, you basically give them all of your information and data, and they are a broker of relationships. A Web3 model is about self-sovereign ownership. Ownership of your data, ownership of any asset that you have that might be a monetary type asset. It might be a unit of data that has some value. It could be any of these things. Web3 is the concept that you have more ownership, identification, sovereignty over that information in a way that you don't have in Web2. You just simply don't have it, okay? That they say if you're not, you know, paying for the product, you are the product. In Web3, the idea is that the product is something you co-create with other people and that you have ownership over what you're putting into the system. Okay, so Web3 technologies are a broad spectrum of technologies, most of which are rooted on the back end on a blockchain that you so well described. And I think the important thing to note is that a lot of those are going to be about non-traditional exchanges of value. So not just what we would call money, whether we'd call it money formally or not formally, certainly not just currency. Okay, so that's really important. And a lot of those uses are just now emerging and erupting into the spotlight. And they're getting a lot more of the attention. I'll give you one quick example. You think about AI, okay? And this is like the bit, everyone's talking about AI. I actually was just in Switzerland doing rounds to explain to people, you can't just think about AI in a silo. It doesn't work, right? AI is part of a tech stack. And if we evolve to a world where my AI agent is recording this podcast with your AI agent, right, stand-ins for us, there is a world in which we can code those agents to be able to do certain things, to be blocked from doing certain things, et cetera. You would think that would become increasingly important over time, right? What is the way to secure those permissions? A blockchain, without getting too technical, is an excellent way of securing those permissions, right? So I said in Davos and just other places, we can't talk about technologies as if they are siloed. It's this thing and this thing and this thing and this thing. At some point, you have to bring them all together. And I use this now infamous analogy of a hamburger where I said, you know, you could talk about AI, crypto, quantum computing, cybersecurity as the lettuce, the tomato, the meat or meat substitute, the bun, right? And those are all legitimate conversations. At some point, you also have to talk about the sandwich, about the hamburger. You know, so we're at the time where that's important. And the blockchain and Web3 are going to play an increasingly valuable role in that space. Okay, so that is all the kind of quasi-financial, non-financial uses. But we're here to talk about financial inclusion. And there, I think, cryptocurrencies or blockchain-based digital currencies also get a bad rap. Because the reality is, there have been tremendous inroads into markets, into places that we know have been problematic for years. The most obvious example is remittances. So as you and your listeners will well know, remittances, you know, hundreds of millions of dollar market, $700 billion by some estimates. The cost of sending a remittance as of June 23 was 6.2% to send $200, okay? The SDG target was 3% by 2030. Okay, so it's getting better. It used to be almost 10% in 2009. It's come down. But you know what the average cost of that for a crypto usage send is for remittance?
Tell me.
It's closer to 1% to 2%.
Wow.
Massive, massive difference, okay? And that adds up really, really, really fast. Even the slower ones that are doing this are costing really on the average of $1.50 per transaction, which is really not a lot of money. It's a lot of money in certain contexts, but sending Bitcoin to another wallet, when you can aggregate that and do it as one comprehensive transaction and you amortize that cost across a number of different transactions, winds up being the cheapest option on the market. Okay. And we've seen a lot of uptake on remittances. Now, banks are the most expensive. They're about 12%. And crypto remains the cheapest. It ranges, you know, but you can get down to 2%. And that's really important. So what I think is critical to know is that it's not just me saying this as someone in the industry. You've got UNHCR, UN refugee agencies, right, talking about this. MoneyGram is actually deploying and using on the back end cryptocurrencies for some of its cross-border transmissions. Why is it so expensive to engage in remittance payments? Because you have to go cross-border. And because of a variety of what's called de-risking behavior by banks, many banks don't even have a correspondent bank. They don't even operate in a certain country. So you have to make multiple hops, bank to bank to bank to bank, to penetrate and get money into certain countries. With crypto, none of those borders or limits exist. You're transmitting from a wallet to a wallet, and that wallet can be anywhere in the world. So you're eliminating a lot of those hops, which all come with expense, with costs, with fees. You can do it more directly. You can do it in what's called a peer-to-peer manner, directly from my wallet to your wallet in many cases, right? So all of these things have resulted in reductions in costs, and we have seen that have real effects. And of course, those effects are felt primarily, as we know, by women.
Okay, first of all, I love the hamburger analogy. I can see why that really, really took off. Like, that's great.
The thing, all the things I said, this is the thing. But there it is. You know, you don't always get to pick the winners, and there it is.
Oh, that's so great.
Glad it resonates.
But that example of crypto and how it really brings down the cost, increases the affordability for people with an impact on a real life need, I think is an excellent one. We know that women use remittances and are both senders and receivers of remittances, but thinking to the broader product mix, we also see like a really big gender gap in account access. We see gender gaps in other products. There's a $1.7 trillion credit gap, gender credit gap in the world among women-owned MSMEs compared to men-owned MSMEs. And a lot of what's driving this is women's unique challenges that they face in accessing financial services. So how does crypto address and mitigate some of those challenges?
Yeah. Well, one of the things about crypto wallets, and this is not universally true in every geography in the world, so I want to just start by saying that, and that is because of regulation or the lack thereof, okay? But in many economies, especially economies with volatile fiat currencies and others, right? So a lot of parts of Latin America, a lot of parts of Sub-Saharan Africa, a lot of parts of ASEAN, island nations, we are seeing the ability for women to open a digital wallet online. You do not need to have your husband's ID or, you know, whatever, or even your own ID for that matter, right? You can open a digital wallet online in many parts of the world with your own credentialing. Now, if you have to, what's called KYC that wallet, you have to have identification, okay? But in some cases, in some parts of the world, that is not necessary. We've actually seen the ability for women in Iran during the protests there to get funding directly in Bitcoin into digital wallets they control and own that no one else even knows exists.
That's amazing. Right?
In Afghanistan, we've seen women who were able to go in and get digital wallets and again, transact in Bitcoin. For ways to pay their education, for whatever they need to do, in some cases to get visas, as it turns out, which is a different use case, which is complicated in its own way. But doing that, and with no knowledge from the patriarch or whoever else was sort of controlling their access. So there was no way they could have gotten a bank account. Impossible, like absolutely impossible. But they could, because of an internet connection at their local library, in some cases in their home, in some cases on their phone, they were able to get access to this. And the reality is, a critical thing to note is, they control the password equivalent, which is called a private key. And no one can take that from them. And it's not findable. You can't necessarily, like, the way that your identification is held is discrete and it is pseudonymous. So no one can go online and know that you have an account with this particular wallet provider or whatever it is. So we've seen this be highly relevant and highly crucial in some cases. Now, that is not happening at massive scale, and be very honest, right? Part of that is the regulation around this. Part of that is really complicated to do. The user interface, like how to get these things, was complicated. So a lot of training was happening through people like the Human Rights Foundation and others who were trying to educate activists and others on how to hold these wallets. The good news is, as the interface gets a little bit less technically complicated, we're going to see more and more of this opportunity, and people can avail themselves of this with more ease than they could, you know, even last year.
And now a word from our sponsor. EY applauds Women's World Banking for their 45 years of service advancing financial inclusion opportunities for women. Together, we have a common vision to build a better financial services industry, one that is stronger, fairer, and more sustainable. Find out more at ey.com. And I can see how that would be gender transformative. So not just working within existing structures, but kind of bypassing them where it's necessary. That's great.
Yeah.
I want to talk now about representation in the crypto space. This is something we think about a lot at Women's World Banking. Like when we look at fintechs, for example, we often see people in Silicon Valley making decisions that affect a low-income person in Africa, for example, and data scientists making decisions about algorithms, but not knowing anything about the people that the algorithms are actually scoring. And so I'd love for you to talk a little bit about the diversity of voices in the cryptocurrency and blockchain space, and whether we're moving in the right direction or what needs to be done to increase representation.
So I have so much to say on this topic. So whatever you want to switch topics, let me know, because I can go all day on just this topic. Okay, so
go for it.
So I have been in and around the technology sector in various ways since 2004. Okay, so it's been almost 20 years that I've been in and around Silicon Valley. I've also seen startup ecosystems in, you know, everywhere from, you know, New York, Tel Aviv, Dakar, like all over the place, right? So I will tell you that the reality is there is tremendous diversity in who is building and using these technologies and other technologies. The problem is that that is not reflected in the loudest voices. Who gets the airtime? Who gets the press? Who gets the huge funding? Who gets to build the unicorn company, right? That has not really changed very much. So the access, the users, the builders, all of that is, I would say that crypto is one of the more diverse ecosystems. I said in 2017, when I first joined the World Economic Forum, I predicted, and this came to pass, we were going to see a lot more interest in building from countries in Sub-Saharan Africa, in Latin America, in ASEAN, than we were going to see in the United States or in Britain or even in parts of Europe, right? Mm-hmm. Switzerland accepted because they were really crypto-friendly very early on and attracted a ton of builders on deliberately, with a deliberate strategy. But apart from that sort of coaxing, you know, encouragement, we're going to see more building happening in those regions because the use case in a financial space was more relevant. When you have a hyperinflationary or highly volatile currency, an alternative currency that's more stable is very attractive. In the United States, when you have for most people in the United States, and this is a majority statement, it's certainly not for everyone, that's very important to land, but for most people, the existing banking system works okay-ish, okay? It is not an acute problem in the United States the way it is in Argentina, right? Other parts of the world where it's an acute issue, okay? So you're going to see this alternative being more popular in those places and more interesting in those places. Exactly what we saw. And that remains, like that extensibility means that you had Colombia, the country of Colombia. I actually went down there and helped them stand up a blockchain division at their national university to train people in the technology and things around it. The government leaned into this very heavily, right? So you saw a lot of that. Now, the problem is that it is still the case. A lot of the funding comes out of the same places it came before. It comes from the same, who are the people who made money? Well, I named some of these people. Like when I came and worked in philanthropy, a lot of my clients were that last generation of tech billionaires. They were all white men. They all went to a handful of universities. They all knew each other. They all lived like miles away from each other in the same small geographic region, right? That has not really changed. What made crypto very attractive to builders is you actually had a mechanism for raising money using a token or a coin. That had a lot of problems. There were a lot of Ponzi type schemes that resulted, but there also was a chance for folks to get capital without having to go to a traditional bootstrapping because their families have no money, right? Self-bootstrapping, they don't have any money, or venture kind of model or seed investor. They don't have those networks, right? So they could do it themselves. And you saw a lot of those turn into really positive projects. So that's kind of one thing. Secondly, I think we cannot separate the challenges around diversity in crypto from diversity in tech in general. They are one and the same. Okay, so when I look around, it's not like I'm seeing a much better outcome in AI or in quantum or in space tech. I am still seeing dominance by a handful of voices who, to their credit, are doing incredible innovative work. But so are a lot of other people who do not get that airtime, don't get that attention, don't get that funding model, don't get that credibility. And it's a media problem. It's a venture problem. It's a confidence to some extent, honestly, problem. And to me, it fundamentally comes down to who do we empower in our societies to take risks? Who do we empower to take risks? We don't usually empower women. We don't empower impoverished people. We don't empower parents, quite frankly, right? There are certain categories of people that are not as empowered to take the kind of risk it takes to jump in and start, you know, engaging in something highly risky, right? That is probably going to fail because most startups fail. It is not something that we have prioritized in our society in a way that has addressed the problem at its core. So I'm not discouraged because I think the progress has been extremely slow, but it has been steady. But I actually will candidly tell you, I actually think one of the most important roles I play, apart from being an expert in all this stuff, is being a very, very visible woman of color in this space, because that is not a very common thing, and it should be. And so I see when I was at WEF, part of my role was to pull on that stage, right, to bring to Davos people from other jurisdictions beyond the US, Switzerland, you know, London, the kind of standard places, even China for that matter, and bring some of those voices to say, this is much more interesting of a community than, you know, than the press would kind of have you believe based on who sort of gets top billing, who gets to go on the news programs, who gets to, you know, all those things, right? I wish I knew how to solve it overnight. I don't, but a lot of us are paying a lot of attention to it.
Well, I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing. I do think it's an important role that you're playing in addition to all of the expertise that you bring. So thanks for playing that role. I'd like to talk now a little bit about challenges. And you mentioned towards the beginning of our conversation you mentioned the challenge of crypto kind of getting a bad rap and criminals using it. And another challenge I've heard is concerns about consumer protection. Like, do people know what they're getting into? The Ponzi scheme comes to mind. I mean, even my mother-in-law, like 5 years ago, was like, this crypto thing, should we get into that? Should we do that? Yeah. And I'm like, well, let's talk about it. So I imagine this is something you think about a lot at the Crypto Council for Innovation. Can you tell me how you're ensuring robust consumer protection and also allowing really interesting innovation and risks to happen in this space?
It's a balance. A core tenet of our advocacy is to say, you know, and we tell this to industry all the time, it's good for industry to have consumer protection regulations in place. It is good. It helps with mainstream adoption. It helps with normalization. It helps address fear. And also, let us be real. It has been a real problem in the industry, right? Like, it's not as if this is hypothetical. It is very real and it needs to be addressed. Now, I will tell you, almost every jurisdiction in the world has done something to prevent what happened in 2018 from ever happening again, except for the federal Washington, D.C. establishment. Everybody else, There's been state stuff. There's been the UK moved on things, Europe moved on things, Japan, South Korea, like a lot of places, right? Nothing out of Washington. Now, that is not because there's not appetite to do something. It's because Washington is in a very peculiar moment where it is very hard. And just whatever day this airs, look at the news. I'm sure there'll be some story about the dysfunction in Washington because it is a daily and ongoing drama. And, you know, this industry is being caught up in that like everybody else. So I think it's crucially important. And so something I'll say, right? I don't think we can have an honest conversation about digital currencies at all and about crypto without addressing and talking about the legacy of financial trauma that exists in the world, right? So when you look across the world, what I see is I see exclusion that has happened at the country level through de-risking of entire countries, through sanctions, whether well-intentioned or not, whether necessary for some time or not, have had crippling effects on economies, communities. Okay, this is like everything from redlining the United States, I would say korematsu, an internment, to quasi-genocidal activities, to refugees, to migration, communities, and individuals, people who, for whatever reason, you know, in some cases, maybe you have a misdemeanor on your record, maybe you can't, whatever reason, just cannot get access to basic financial services. And the thing is, when you talked, we did this big survey of Black builders in crypto, and I thought they were going to say, oh, you know, we build in this because we can, it's this and that, the other thing. It was two things. One, we don't get capital and we need capital. And this way we can get capital. And two was, I'm not going to go to a bank. You know how banks treated my mother, my aunt, my older brother, my grandmother, my community? Like, why would I go to a bank for this stuff? I don't trust them. I don't trust them because my family's story is one of not being able to trust those institutions to do right by people who look like me. So I testified in front of the California Assembly and State Senate last year. I don't know what it was. Time has no meaning. Last year, I think. And I talked about exactly this. We have to address that legacy of financial trauma. And the reason people were flocking into crypto as an alternative is in part because crypto was drawing them in ways that frankly were misleading and in some cases just disgusting, frankly, but also because they saw it as an alternative system that was not working for them, right? And that fundamental truth has to be acknowledged. So we're talking about consumer protection. It cannot be about cutting off access because the demand exists. And that demand was not just because they saw some ad. All of that happened a lot later. All the advertising, all that kind of thing, that didn't happen in crypto until like 2020 or so. It really was not prevalent. People were going to this opportunity because they saw it as a way to make up a gap and to make up a delta in what offerings were available to them. And that is just a crucial reality. So our take on this, to answer your question more directly, when it comes to consumer protection, it has to be about empowerment, about user empowerment. And that can come from education. It can come from, you know, guardrails, right, that exist or sort of boundaries placed on certain kinds of things. It can come from requirements around how you do advertising is not crazy, right? That things like that that can come into play that are going to help with folks who maybe are not as able to spot something that seems that is too good to be true on its face and maybe need a little bit of guidance to help understand that that is what it is, right? But it should not be about restricting access. The last thing I'll say on this is something that's bothered me for a very long time in the United States is this concept of accredited investors. The idea being, unless you have enough money, you are not allowed to take advantage of certain opportunities. You are not, the people guise it as, oh, you're not sophisticated enough, you're not educated. No, you're just not rich enough, right? That's all it is. All the rest of it is, it's just a dog whistle. It's a dog whistle that basically is saying, we just don't want to deal with the fact that when you get wiped out, you're done for. When super wealthy X person gets wiped out, we don't really care. That's what it's about. I find that very offensive because anyone I've ever known who struggles and is poor, frankly, is poor by whatever definition you're using, international ones, local ones, you know, let me tell you, they are very careful with their dollar. They're not just frittering it away on nonsense on a regular basis, right? And to the extent that they're engaging in activities, this crypto gets analogized to gambling a lot, they are doing that with some thought behind it. Not always, but in many cases. And so the idea that just because you're poor, you don't have the ability to make a risk-weighted assessment of what to do with your hard-earned money, I find very offensive. At the same time, it shouldn't be the case that you can just like click on a thing because you see an ad with some basketball player or whatever, I mean, you know, or an artist or whatever it is, right? Some actor, and you're like, oh, well, Matt Damon told me to do a thing. I'm going to click, 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 and then I'm it shouldn't be that easy either, you know? So we've been talking a lot to various states about how do you create just-in-time education around this stuff? Because the reality is the Instagram ad world we live in means that people are clicking through and doing all kinds of nonsense because the addictive mechanisms that exist and the targeted advertising makes that popular to them. But how do you provide some sort of interface or frame that forces you to take a pause and think about what am I getting into? What does this mean? What is the possible return? What are the alternatives? What are the options that I have? But placing this as one of a set of options acknowledges that the demand exists, but it also creates a safer way to engage in the investment should you choose to make that investment. I use investment very narrowly, but as an example.
Well, and you just answered one of my next questions, which was going to be on financial literacy. Mm. And I loved the way you just talked about the responsibility of companies providing cryptocurrency services or providing cryptocurrency, having some responsibility to, as they provide that service, also be educating customers on what it is and what it will mean for them, alongside of broader financial industry responsibility to give consumers all the options that they need to make a good decision.
And look, it goes all the way down to sort of primary school and secondary school education. You know, financial literacy and that kind of education is something I think is core. And, you know, when I said this to my public school teacher friends, they're like, you know, we're trying to teach kids to read. We're not also able to take, and I totally understand that. I hear that. But I think it has to be a systemic acknowledgement that that gap is not something that any company can solve on its own, right? Like you can't go all the way back through here's checking account. I mean, you can do some just-in-time education about like, if you are making an investment, here's this compared to that, compared to the other thing. You know, here's a money market, whatever it is. But you can't go all the way back and gap fill that entire, it's just not reasonable. And right. So the question becomes, where's that responsibility lie? And I think it's multi-part. I think it lies in a variety of places, you know, to kind of provide that education. It's a difficult question. And I think there's also a question of technical literacy, right? The technical literacy question is huge. I'm seeing my own children as they proceed through school, every time they hit a grade, right? Like I have three kids, so they hit second grade three times, you know, but by the third one, it's just a very different conversation around, you know, online safety and like clicking on things and, you know, all this kind of stuff is very, it's much more sophisticated now than it was for my oldest, right? And so we have to evolve how we think about what literacy means in this context as things get faster and as it gets harder, you know, easier to kind of like make these decisions without having to have any sort of gating around it. We have to think about what that means and what literacy looks like. And that again is a societal question. It's not just one for the crypto industry because it involves things like buy now, pay later, like all kinds of other things that are there as well, where education is really key so that people can make informed decisions. It's not saying that product is always terrible. That's not true. The product is terrible to some, but it's actually great for others. And how do you know which one you are? Well, you have to make that assessment yourself and you need the information to make that assessment on your own.
Yeah, and I wish I could go back to elementary school and learn what they're learning now, because I remember in my financial literacy, the only thing I remember is how to write a check, which I have not done in years. I don't know what you're
at the time, that was very relevant, right?
Yeah, so relevant. And then like not at all relevant to my adult life. And so, I love that you're thinking about how to structure choices and how to get just-in-time reminders or nudges out to people, how to fill in those gaps, because while kids might be learning about the full range of financial services now, although I'm not sure, my kids are a little bit younger than that.
They're really not.
All right. Well, there we go. I mean, that's
what is an investment? You know, like that's really great. You know, why do you save? You know, like things like that, which are great, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a start anyway.
It's a start.
We went so quickly and through the time, and I have like 5 questions left. I'd love to end on a forward thinking question for you. Like, if you can envision the world 5 years from now, what do you want the crypto space to look like?
Oh, that's such a great question. Thank you for asking that question. So, well, first of all, I would like no one to ever talk about blockchain ever. I would like that to have retreated into an invisible part of technical infrastructure that no normal person needs to understand or whatever, right? It's what does that do and what does it unlock that's interesting? And the technical parts of that, I would like to not talk about ever. Similarly, I actually think that the crypto concept, you know, it's complicated, because I actually think the better term is digital assets or even digital objects. Because as noted, I got into this from the data side. And data is going to increasingly have more and more value, whether it's your identity, whether it's your credential that you have. That may not be monetizable value, but it has undeniable value now. Like, frankly, my Harvard degree has unlocked doors for me that are worth tremendous. I don't monetize that literally, right? But it is so important. And if someone could claim they had my degree, you know, that would be challenging, right? So credentialing, it's a bad example, but credentialing, identification, things like this are going to become increasingly important. And I think we have to recognize the world is moving to a more and more digital place. And the intermediation of our digital and offline and online lives is becoming more and more fluid. And that is also demographically shifting very rapidly with the coming generation. So I would like crypto to be less of the topic of conversation. I'd like far less interest in what's the market doing, what are the indices doing, blah, 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 the financial part of it, and much more in this idea that we have created a system that crypto is but one part of, AI is part of this as well, a system where we as individuals and communities are empowered to make choices for ourselves about how we share information, who gets access to the information, everything from health information to, you know, grades to credentials to all kinds of things. We get that kind of access. And then also this idea that the Web2 platform model of we're going to take your data and then sell you ads is something that is just, it's kind of gone. Like we've just sort of dispensed with the idea that that is the way. You know, because it's not the way, or it's the way for a small handful of people who are making a lot of money off of that, but it is not the way forward. And the way forward is really about getting back to basics and saying, we need to be empowered participants in all of these systems, online, offline, and that's going to look different in different cultural, social, even economic contexts. But that fundamental core, I would like to see be a reality in ways that are both subtle and very overt.
That I love that vision. I think that's so interesting. I wanted
5
to
years
ask,
is past. But maybe 10 years.
Maybe 10 years. I don't know. I think you can be a little bit more ambitious about that.
5 years. Let's manifest 5 years. Okay. Let's do it.
Is this something that the financial inclusion, and especially the women's financial inclusion community, should be focused on? I told you I was going to end with a forward-looking question, but I guess I just have one more. Is we have limited resources in this financial inclusion community space. We're very aware of the fact that even traditional financial services are not serving people, but also that like not everybody has a cell phone. Personal technology device adoption might be growing, but internet access is not all there? Like, is this something I should be looking at, Sheila?
You know, I think it's something to have in your peripheral vision. So when you say focused, I think my answer would probably be no. Aware of, 100%, absolutely. You do need to be aware of what's happening in this space. And I say that because when I was at the WEF, we did this study on financial inclusion and stablecoin specifically. And the reality is that no technology is going to solve the problems you're talking about. It's not going to solve numeracy, literacy, internet access. Like, none of those things are solved by any technology that's built. But what these technologies are doing is paving the way forward for the future. So I spend a lot of my time thinking about, you know, broadband, rural infrastructure. I think those things are where I would say that is something everyone should be focused on, like closing digital divide, closing the access questions around infrastructure in particular. That is something worthwhile for everyone. Like, everybody should be focusing on that. And in my opinion, that's like literally everybody who works in almost any industry anywhere, because that is going to be the major axis of which exclusion is happening, is this access to this kind of infrastructure. So that's crucial. But this stuff, I think, the use cases that I mentioned are really important. So I think cross-border payments, if there's an element of financial inclusion where the sub-element of cross-border things like remittances, absolutely. Because this is happening right now. And so thinking about how to do more education around that and the opportunity there is important. But as a general matter, I would say I still think it's growing and emerging. So it's something you should definitely be aware of and educating yourself about. But I don't know that putting scarce resources from the financial inclusion world into this space at this precise moment is, and I'll get trouble for this from some of the people in the industry, but candidly, that's not what I think is the most crucial and important thing for you all to be doing with your resources at this moment. That may change. It'll change as infrastructure access gets better. It'll change as demographics shift. The younger generations want more and more of this. But right now, a lot of the money is still held by women of a different generation. And the reality is, I don't necessarily see that demographic jumping into some of these opportunities if they haven't already. So the question becomes, how do you serve those matriarchs, those head of households, those folks who are making decisions and meet them where they are, which may be with a mobile device with no internet access, right? And being very mindful and practical about that, I think remains crucial, which I know you all are. So that will shift. And so I would say 5 years from now, very different answer. Yes, this should be a focus. So up to you how you kind of ramp up to that time frame. But that's how I would answer that question with some detail.
I love that honesty and nuance. And what I hear you saying is watch the use cases, watch the innovation, make sure that you know when it's time to really jump in feet
first. There will be a time.
Yeah, that's great. Sheila, thank you so much for your time. And thanks for giving us more of your time than I asked for.
All good. My really pleasure. Thanks, Sonia.
Thanks. I just have a few reflections thinking about that conversation with Sheila. First of all, Women's World Banking often talks about this women-centered design methodology when it comes to financial services. And the metaphor that she gave us at the beginning of the whole hamburger or the whole sandwich, thinking about all of those different elements and how they work together for the design of financial services, keeping women's needs in mind, I think is critical. And there's maybe not one answer for each household that's out there or for each woman. But what I know is that women do value privacy and they do value self-sovereignty in their financial services. And it does sound like there's really strong promise in the crypto space and some really exciting use cases. Second, one thing we didn't get to talk about that I wish, maybe in part two, we'll talk about this. Second, gender disaggregated data. There is just so much we don't know about this space in terms of uptake and participation. We learn it from surveys, but I think there's just a lot more that we can find out and keep an eye on as this space continues to grow. Third, it just sounds like there's so much in flux and there's a lot of room for individual consumers around the world to participate by engaging with policymakers, sharing your insights, asking really good questions. And it sounds like there are spaces in which to do that. And then finally, Importantly, if you found our discussion valuable today, don't forget to subscribe and rate and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. This is really important to us, to me personally, because it helps us to bring you content that resonates with you. You can stay engaged, you can stay informed, and we look forward to connecting with you in our next episode, which will be during Women's History Month on March 21st. That's the third Thursday of the month.